Well, hello everybody. Nice to see you all. Welcome to this event, is one that I've long been waiting for. I'm Alpa Shah, I'm a professor of anthropology and a convener of the Global Economies of Care research theme here at the III. We're here to discuss homelessness and care with three anthropologists who are fresh out of deep immersive fieldwork. Not in some remote tribe on the other side of the world, but right here on our doorstep in London and Cambridge and also in Paris. In various ways, they've all been studying homelessness and homes without people. What we're trying to achieve today is a conversation about what their collective insights can reveal about, well, their anthrovision reveals about homelessness and care. Two of the most important issues facing attempts to address inequality and poverty today. I take the anthrovision term from, the FT journalist and editor and writer Gillian Tett, who in her recent book, Anthrovision, used this concept to draw attention to what anthropologists have been long doing, immersing themselves in one's in other cultures, in people who seem different to you, being obsessed with curiosity and things that seem strange, in a deliberate attempt to make them familiar on closer understanding and even revealing how strange our original understandings were. As she points out, this is not based on surveys, but on deep fieldwork we anthropologists live with and work with and observe and talk to people we want to understand. Without this deep understanding, we force fit meaning onto others, and we're often blind to what may be hidden in plain sight. As far as policy is concerned, we can make costly mistakes, at worst, create policy which might even be detrimental to those who we wish to serve. I think, in this world where we're shaped by artificial intelligence more and more, anthropological intelligence and its lateral vision can't be ignored and is more important than ever. So let me introduce you to our speakers. Johannes Lenhardt is an ethnographer of homelessness and venture capital. And in the last decade, from his basis at Cambridge and the University of Cambridge, he conducted fieldwork in London, Paris, and Cambridge with people experiencing homelessness. And this work has resulted in a monograph, Making Better Lives, about to be published in May this year. Johannes, we look forward to it. Since 2017, his fieldwork has focused on the other side, on the ethics of startup investors in the Silicon Valley in New York, London, and Berlin. And he says he's preparing a second monograph on this, The Kingmakers. Simon Torfik, our very own Simon Torfik, a PhD candidate in our department and a Leverhulme program participant in the international inequalities here, both at the London School of Economics. His research, Simon and Mayanka, who I'm about to introduce, Simon's research draws on his professional experience of conducting casework in homeless charities in the UK. Mayanka, an LSE fellow in social anthropology, and her doctoral research has looked at empty houses in central London. She's carried out fieldwork in both council estates and in luxury squares in Chelsea, focusing on practices of care and belonging that emerge alongside emptiness. And alongside her academic work, she's been running mentoring and storytelling sessions with low-income tenants in Brent in London, and she's been creating spatial ethnographies for architects who are working on urban regeneration. As chair to this event today, I'm going to first invite each of our speakers to tell us a little bit about their research and how they did it. And once we've heard from them all, we will go into discussion, again led by the speakers, of what each of their research, what their fieldwork reveals about the wider policy implications and their revelations. Their revelations, their anthrovision. So just please note, we have a live captioner, a BS and BSL interpreters at today's event. To activate the captions, you click on the CC button at the bottom of your screens. You can also access the larger captions by using the link that has been posted in the chat. Yeah, if you want to make use of the BSL interpreting, use the pin the two interpreters to your screen. Okay, we're gonna run for about 1 hour and 30 minutes. There's an anthropology party in the on the sixth floor of the student building starting soon. So you're all welcome to that. And as this is a Zoom meeting rather than the webinar format, it would be great to see you so that we can have a more interactive event. But please keep yourselves muted. And there'll be a chance to ask questions at the end of the event. Please use your raise hand functions if you can. Otherwise, you can put your questions in chat. Okay, I'll announce the next public event at the end of the event. So for now, over to our speakers, Johannes, to you first. And then Simon, and then Mayanka, Johannes.
Yeah, Alper, thanks so much for having me and for hosting this event today, which I think is bringing a topic of conversation to an audience that we experience is not always focused on this or focused on this in a slightly different way, very much with the opposite of what we are providing, which is an anthropological insight. There's great work being done, particularly on the UK, when it comes to understanding homelessness and policies, but most of that is quantitative. Most of it by people who don't really speak with people experiencing homelessness. And I think all three of us are coming from a very different angle. I started in 2011 when I first moved to London and was quite shocked and surprised, never having lived in a city as metropolitan as London before, that where I set foot in Shoreditch at the time was a place where, which is slightly different now actually, lots of people were begging. So interestingly enough, while I say I work on homelessness and I work with people experiencing homelessness, who I really work with are actually two slightly more specific constituencies and informants, people who beg, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second, and people who are sleeping rough. And to give you an idea of what that means is, it's about what statistically speaking is quote unquote the bottom 10% of what we count as people experiencing homelessness, which really ranges from people who are actually, and often in our imagination, that is the people that we are seeing when we say a homeless person, people who are actually sleeping on the street, to people who are in various different types of accommodation, like the ones that Simon studied and looked at and worked in as well. So most of my work, ethnographically speaking, and with fieldwork in London, where I spent 3 summers consecutively from 2012 onwards doing graduate work, 2 years in Paris, and then more recently in Cambridge in various different setups, was with the people who are actually on the street, outside of institutional contexts. This was partly inspired by my personal observations moving to London and starting to talk to these people. And I always remember when I first heard about anthropology, to give you a flavor of what, for all of you who do not do ethnography, what it looks like doing ethnography with people. One of my teachers at Cambridge told me, "Oh yeah, ethnography is hanging out. That's it. There's not much more to it." And obviously, he was partly joking, but the attunement that you are generating by spending a lot of time with people in a long stretch of time on top of that, rather than just in brief intervals, is exactly that. You're becoming friends. And that is what happened both with the people that I encountered in London, and then even more so for the 2 years that I spent with a group of about 30 people around the Gare du Nord, so Europe's biggest train station in Paris, which historically has been a hub for people arriving, obviously, and it still is. And that often comes, and it does that too, with being a hub for drug trading and trafficking more generally and trade more generally. And then more recently in Cambridge, I try and spend significant amounts of time with people rather than asking them questions. So the opposite between doing interviews, which is what I do now with my expert venture capital investors, and what I do and continue to do and used to do on a day-to-day basis with people experiencing homelessness, is being there, being with them, being in the situations next to them. And that comes with problems we might want to talk about later, because I am not a person experiencing homelessness. I am not a person who begs. How is that line differentiated and made clear? Was one of the challenges that I definitely had in my fieldwork encounters, particularly because I wasn't the volunteer mostly in settings where volunteers are normal, and it would have been totally normal for me to be there. I was on the street sitting next to a person who was begging. But again, I'm trying to provide, and that is also the focus of my monograph, a perspective from the bottom up, from people who are literally and symbolically speaking, mostly looking up at other people because they're sitting down, asking other people for money for nothing. So both in the work I did in London and in the work I did in Paris, I started with private detective, like looking around where people gather and back. And it really felt a bit getting access to the field, which is what the kind of technical terms are for this, was a game of private detective being, so to speak, trying to figure out where are people and what do they do and who speaks with whom and where do they go together, before I started talking to people directly and explicitly and introduced myself as who I was, which was a student at the time who was trying to understand how, and this is the core of my questions and has been for the last decade of me studying this, how do you survive ultimately? What do you do? What are the different practices that you engage in order to, despite your marginalization and despite your expressive exclusion from various parts of society, how do you still make a life, and how do you possibly even make a slightly better life than what you are presented with? I want to show you a very quick succession of pictures before I'm handing over, just to give you an idea of what it is that I was looking at. So again, the biggest focus of what I studied was people. This is actually a charity poster that was used at the time of my research in Paris, but it's an interesting symbolic affiliation with people who I encountered, people experiencing homelessness or people who beg, and a message of what should we take from these people, right? There's learnings that this charity in particular was focusing on. That is a picture that I took in Paris at the Gare de l'Est, so the neighboring train station, and something that I focused a lot of my energy on because it's not just begging that people engage in order to make a better life, which obviously is around making money, but it's also shelter making. And this is a shelter of somebody who I got to know very, very well, who, as you can see, was incredibly orderly. And one of the major focus points of his kind of day-to-day doing was keeping this particular niche in the train station's direct proximity in order. And there were particular bags that had particular types of clothes in it, particular types of bags for food. So this was what I ended up calling homemaking, in the sense of shelter making, that I observed again and again. And actually, I still walk through many cities from London to New York to San Francisco, where I see this and recognize this activity that I think is an innately human activity of bringing a space under control that actually, theoretically speaking, is something that Mary Douglas pointed out as a kind of distinction between purity and danger. What I also looked at, and what I published a paper on recently, is what we are all quite familiar with, but often don't recognize as what it is, what some people call anti-homeless architecture. So the interventions, and that takes us to the policy direction immediately that we're talking about later, that we as society, and in this particular case, it's the private train company, public-private train company in Paris, that puts particular, mostly metal architectural features in place, very implicitly, they obviously couldn't explicitly admit this, and I had conversations with them explicitly about this, to shut people out. Just to point at the first one here, that was a niche that emanated hot air. And this particular piece of metal was doing nothing but keeping people from going into that niche to warm themselves up. So perhaps an observation here that again speaks to what we do as ethnography, anthrovision, because I was seeing people and accompanying people and talking to people who were hiding in this niche regularly. When I saw the piece of metal here, I had a totally different understanding from somebody who would have just come by and just had seen this securing piece of metal. And then perhaps the last piece of direct observation from my fieldwork, which ended up going into different institutional setups, including a shelter where I spent 3 months altogether following my informants through, again, what Simon is going to talk about, into housing. And what I observed there was an enormous amount of printouts ultimately. And the left one here is a description of what you're supposed to be doing with your rubbish that people were supposed to be following. So I ended up describing these situations from, again, the perspective of the people who were thrown into these, not exactly against their will, but not out of free choice, and where they were presented with an awful lot of rules that actually then prevented many people of properly making home in these institutional setups and leaving to go back to the street. But I don't want to leave you with an unhappy note. Hopefully coming back to this point in a second, but now handing back to Alpa.
Actually, this is the perfect place to hand over to Simon, who then goes and looks into those institutional settings. So Simon Tofik, PhD student in the department, hopefully completing his thesis soon. Simon, come and tell us about your research, please.
Yes, thank you so much, Alpa, for this, your introduction, and for curating this array of perspectives. And also thank you, Johannes, for providing a very important and eloquent map for what an anthropology of homelessness is. Thank you both. So a bit about me. I conducted ethnographic research of homeless organizations, precisely those that Johannes ended on. And I studied these organizations in an English city between 2018 and 2020. In other words, I spent 18 months simply volunteering and working in homeless charities, such as night shelters and advice services. In my research, to protect the identity of my colleagues and friends, I'll refer to the locality as Castlebury. So homelessness is a well-worn subject of research, of course, so I took a different tack. What researchers of homelessness less commonly do is to study homelessness precisely from the perspective of those charity workers whose mission it is to end homelessness. I found that this mission was plagued with difficulties and contradictions on the front line. My colleagues and I could often only provide short-term fixes. Despite our best efforts, there was always a discrepancy between the overarching mission, ending homelessness, and the everyday realities. In other words, the nature of our successes was always limited. I found that the path dependence of these policy responses and the entrenched incentive structures that exist are the macro level problem. This isn't particularly profound, but worth saying very clearly, because in Castlebury, where I worked, only 6 new units of social housing were built in the 8 years preceding my fieldwork. This is not a net figure, by the way, because the selling off of UK public housing has meant that the figure has always been a net reduction since the 1980s. So this is the necessary context. And my anthro vision during my research has been to match up this big picture of the seemingly timeless crisis of homelessness to the everyday acts of care and devotion on the front line. So this impossible job of ending homelessness is the central topic of my academic research. But tonight, what I'm going to be looking at, how I'm going to be deploying my anthrovision, is to talk about something slightly different. And it's about the unexpected acts of care that take place in my former organizations. And this brings me to 2 pictures that I'll now show. Share my screen now. Oh, thank you. So on the right is a typical plate of food, but what's interesting about it was the process in which it was cooked in the shelter that one of the shelters that I worked at, and it's the collective effort of volunteers and shelter residents alike. I effectively put that there because I'm a bit of a foodie and I like what food looks like. What I'll be talking more focused about is the plant on the left, and it was given to a former colleague of mine and a friend of mine now, who I'll call Sarah. A bit more context just before I talk about Sarah's plant. And it's this, which is, in the popular imagination, homeless charities are perhaps considered the biggest agents of care towards the homeless. And what is less appreciated is the possibility of reverse acts of care. What I mean by this is where the beneficiaries of these charities, known as clients, service users, guests, it depends on the context, it's where they exhibit care for their support workers and for each other. So I'm going to dedicate a bit of time to talk about these reverse acts, not just because they seem counterintuitive, but also because in the past, anthropologists haven't been that great at looking at them either in institutional settings, largely because an anthropology of a former anthropology of institutions has largely considered them to be inherently disciplinary and even repressive. And Sarah's plant on the left is an example of a subtle reverse act of care. I'll tell you a little bit about Sarah. So her job is quite innovative, even though Sarah might ordinarily be construed as a support worker, she much prefers to be called a relational worker. This term befits her vocation. She's part of a growing movement in the UK homeless sector to redraw the professional boundaries of the historic caseworker-client relationship. Sarah recognizes that these historically drawn boundaries are potentially quite paternalist. So a key part of Sarah's job has been, in her words, to forge meaningful social relations, a bit like an anthropologist, I suppose. To this end, Sarah dedicatedly organized regular gardening clubs that were open to volunteers, to workers, and to clients alike. One of the gardening club participants, who might be called such a client, had taken a cutting and had gifted it to Sarah. And this took Sarah entirely by surprise. And I'll tell you in her words how she described it, which was, they described how much I love plants and that I had plants at home. To me, it's quite meaningful. They gave me something of theirs that I could take away and nurture. And to have that connection through the plant with that person, even after the end of the professional relationship, I thought it was really sweet and kind. So, when Sarah was recounting to me the biography of this plant, Sarah was reminding me that it had created offshoots of its own now, if you have a look on the right-hand side of the plant. And she told me that she's since been planting these offshoots and giving it away herself. In other words, she described it as a symbol of a gift that keeps on giving. Sarah is not the only one who enjoys these kinds of relations with so-called clients. It's not uncommon for clients to refer to their workers and to volunteers as like my son, like my daughter, like my brother. Anthropologists are used to these examples of fictive kinship, especially in the case of homelessness and in what we call low-income housing. But a lot of these accounts of fictive kinship have suggested that it takes place largely on the streets, never across the professional divides. Anyway, none of this is to suggest that these acts of care in reverse are not viewed with suspicion. In Sarah's words, they are often seen as going against the grain of the traditional culture of us and them. Also, these reverse acts of care and me talking about it, I'm not trying to suggest that these gifts are straightforward. And I'm also not trying to suggest that they avoid key dilemmas about power and inequality. But what these gifts do demonstrate is that these institutions do not have an easy monopoly on care. They are instead profoundly relational. So in summing up, I hope I've painted a nuanced picture of homelessness and in particular of its institutions. And thank you all for listening, and thank you, Emma.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Simon. And I guess we're going to hear more about these practices of care now in unexpected places from Mayanka Mukherjee. Mayanka Mukherjee, an LSC Fellow in the Department of Anthropology. Over to you, Mayanka.
Thank you so much, Alpa, and thank you for holding this space for all of us. And it's great to go after Simon. And I think we're going to continue some of the literal plants and the metaphorical plants in my research as well, which will prop up in relation to looking at everyday practices of care. So while this panel is focused on homelessness, my research looks at the opposite, actually. So it looks at empty homes or homes without people. And hopefully this detour will be a productive line of inquiry into understanding the complex relationship between people and homes in contemporary London by focusing on everyday practices of care that emerge alongside empty homes. My PhD research focused on empty homes in Kensington and Chelsea. And I started my research just after the Grenfell fire, which brought renewed attention to the problem of emptiness, resulting in emotive juxtapositions drawn between people without homes and homes without people, as a means of making a case for the empty homes in the borough to be used for rehousing of Grenfell inhabitants who were rendered homeless by the fire. While newspaper reports often framed empty houses as a new problem, often attached to a particular imagination of a foreigner who is seen to hollow out London, my early fieldwork conversations revealed that emptiness actually took up many, many forms, and some were more villainized while others were normalized and barely seen as problematic. The anthropological lens or the anthrovision allowed me to step away from the sensational and take up a long-term participatory approach that further allowed me to break down this category of empty homes and demonstrate that empty homes have concomitant different moral evaluations and social consequences. This is why I shifted away from the kind of newspaper reporting of empty homes, which was based on a certain process of othering. And instead I looked at the normalized forms of empty homes to understand all the ways in which emptiness was hidden and existed openly as well in the city. For this, I picked two sites. The first was Sutton Estate. It's a council estate holding 150 empty flats in a total of 462 flats. The period of my fieldwork coincided with the unfolding and the eventual rejection of the planning permission bill that sought to demolish this estate and turn it into mixed rent housing development. My fieldwork thus unfolded against the lurking background threat of people fearing the loss of their homes. Emptiness took up many shapes and forms, some imagined and anticipated, like I just mentioned, in this borough of Kensington and Chelsea, where 10% homes are listed also as second homes for council tax purposes. The Freedom of Information report in 2018 revealed that 141 properties owned by the borough, including council flats and other buildings such as schools and police station, lie empty for many calendar days in a year. I'm going to just share my screen. Hopefully you can all see it. Yep. Here is a doodle made by Dorinda, a resident of Sutton Estate and one of my key interlocutors, as she mocks the borough's changing trends, where all shops that make up everyday life, the baker, the butchers, the post office, the convenience store, are all shut down and replaced by what she called glittery stuff. I walk down King's Road to test Dorinda's hypothesis, and I reached Sloane Street and I immediately understood what she meant. I passed three designer stores that were closed off to the public and were hosting private auctions and seasonal sale for VIP members. The retail stores in the area operated on seasonal routines of auctions rather than the everyday shopping model, thereby shaping their own retail models around these cycles of emptiness that define the area. This further reiterated the normalization of particular forms of emptiness that were not being villainized by the media. Along with residents, I also interviewed retail store workers, and my conversation with the manager of a nearby gun shop revealed that emptiness was not really about physical absence. He argued that his business is actually sustained by the continuation of communities. And he argued that there are even families who probably don't stay in London all year around, but they always come back punctually during specific times and participate very meaningfully in community life in a way that people who live in London for large parts of the year may never do. So familiarity and punctuality were seen as the opposite of emptiness rather than fullness or presence. This is an important insight generated through this anthropological lens, that emptiness is not a fixed category or a static category, but rather it's tied to particular ways of performing belonging in a city. Belonging therefore became one of my key analytical lenses to study emptiness. Was belonging antithetical to emptiness, or did it facilitate emptiness? The media narratives on empty houses often focus on areas devoid of communities and sociality, with images of lifeless, ghostly towers and high rises with darkened windows that come to our mind. However, the emptiness I saw before me in Chelsea was rather different. The homes in Cadogan Square, for instance, were historic buildings that were beautiful and cared for. In fact, an interview with a conservation architect in the area confirmed that it is precisely this emptiness of the flats that allow for regular repairs and renovations that maintain the historical value of the properties. The architect also confirmed that luxury houses in Chelsea have always been seasonally occupied, and this is embedded in the ways in which the houses are cared for in the area through the presence of the freeholder, which is the Cadogan family, who see themselves as the custodians of land and community, a term that I'm sure we're all going to talk about in different ways, you know, across these three research projects. And this kind of Cadogan estate, this custodian of land and community, they dictate the correct ways of upkeeping these historical homes. Emptiness in this sense facilitates care and conservation rather than inhibit it. On the other hand, contrary to images of dreariness, the garden of Sutton Estate was also bursting with life and sociality. The gardening group headed by Dorinda, and here it's kind of, you know, brings back what Simon had about the plant and showing this form of care. This gardening group was, you know, created by Dorinda, and it carries out weekly gardening sessions. And it emerged in response to the planning permission that I mentioned earlier, which was to demolish the estate. The housing landlord, Clarion Housing, declared the estate as uninhabitable to justify this process of decanting, which is slowly moving its inhabitants away from their homes to other parts. However, the residents argued that the estate was not uninhabitable, but rather it was being made uninhabitable through this process of emptying. So in this context of emptying, there were these two care practices that became the focus of my ethnography. The first is this one. So the first is gardening, and trees actually emerge as significant protagonists while also becoming constructive points of focus to generate insights about what it means to build roots into a place. The photo you see here on the left is a black and white photo of a tree being planted by a local labor councillor 5 decades ago. And the photo on the left is of Dorinda and Brian, residents of the estate, holding up the photo in front of the tree in its present form. Measurements of time and claims of belonging went hand in hand in this garden. Along with gardening, grieving became the second practice that I focused on in my ethnography. Many of the residents made trip to the nearby Brompton Cemetery where their relatives lay buried. The cemetery became a site where residents of the estate demonstrated their ancestral connections to Chelsea in the face of potential displacement. On Fridays after the gardening session, I often accompanied Chris, a member of the gardening group who you see here, to visit his mom's grave. He had to fight a long battle to bury his mom in the cemetery. And he also managed to book a twin burial plot for himself when he dies. He jokingly said to me that even if he's evicted from Chelsea in his lifetime, he will come back to haunt after his death. Here is a sketch made by Chris, and you can notice how he has kind of marked out, you know, with shading the dents in the soil formed out of the regularity of his visits to his mom's grave. Paying attention to these everyday care practices generates crucial insights that can shape policy efforts to deal with this problem of empty houses and question when exactly do these empty houses become a problem and which empty homes do we mean when we talk about solving this crisis. But I will discuss more of this and its bearings on policy in the second part. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you so much. The way we organize this panel, just to bring our audience in, is that after having told you about the wonderful research that Johannes, Mayanka and Simon have been doing and how they did it, the question was posed to them, okay, so what's the relevance of all this? You know, why is this relevant to policy? Why is this relevant at all in the world? So over to Johannes first, then Simon, then Mayanka on this question. What's the relevance of your anthrovision to the world?
Yeah, that's a tough conversation that I'm having again and again as I'm publishing more, because lots of people doubt that we, with our anecdotal evidence, have any relevance. Interestingly enough, prefacing this conversation, I want to say that there's a push, and I'm seeing this whether I'm talking about people experiencing homelessness or whether I'm talking about, say, diversity and inclusion in venture capital, which there's a lack of, as you might be able to imagine, that we need data. And what people mean when they say we need data is quantitative numbers, some statistic that proves one point or the other. We actually, interestingly enough, have that data in the quantitative ways and in clinical trial studies, for instance, when it comes to quite a few of the issues that we touched on already, and I'm going to touch on in a second. One of them being, how do we actually treat people who are experiencing homelessness and are using drugs? There's very, very good ideas that have been tested for the last 20 years and have been put into practice and studied quantitatively and by people who are not anthropologists, and still they haven't taken foot in the UK or the US. And I'm talking about something like a safe injection facility. The data poses quite a straightforward answer to what should we do with people who are using drugs. We should give them places where they are ultimately taken care of. And in this way that Simon talked about, and I'm going to dive into in a second, they take care of themselves as much as they are being taken care of. But again, the UK and the US have not adopted this. So actually, data in the sense of what many people mean when they talk about it as clinical evidence or statistics don't convince people to change their minds. And I think what does, and what we are very good at, is stories and narratives and proper, not necessarily first person, but experiential encounters. And that's ultimately what a lot of good ethnography unearths and brings to the front, and what good books do, and why I really like writing books with and based on the anthropological research I've been doing. So what do we learn from the type of research that I do and that Simon and Mayanka do? I want to give you two examples of that. One is about begging as work and shelter making. And the other one is about how to treat people that use drugs. And this is both insights from work that I've been doing in London and in Paris. My Cambridge work was much more applied, where I actually did work with policymakers who do at times see the kind of qualities that we bring as something beneficial. So I'm not going to touch on that for now, but let's go back to what I started my work with and what I also started talking about today, begging as work and shelter making in what Auger calls non-places like train stations. So outside of institutional setups on the streets, right? I've been seeing people over the last decade as quintessentially depending on these two practices on a day-to-day basis. They can't survive, it's as simple as that. If they can't, and if they're not allowed to, and that's already what I'm touching on here, to beg, to ask people for money, and to make shelter wildly, basically. It's quintessential for survival on a very simple level that we all don't struggle with on a day-to-day basis. We usually have some kind of an income and we have some kind of a place that we call home that is ultimately a stable house that we can return to and do return to on a day-to-day basis, often symbolized by this, I have a key to a door. This is what the people that I work with and Simon in a lot of senses works with in many situations don't have, right? So a practice like begging and a practice like shelter making are ultimately about making home in the very physical sense of the word. It's about safety, stability, both physical and mentally. What happens unfortunately though, and in Paris until the 90s, sleeping outside was illegal to a point where the police, the city in various different constituencies, would drive around the city and put you into a van and take you to a homeless shelter. You couldn't protest against that. There was no legal grounds that you would be allowed to be outside. And similarly, many countries, including the UK, have gone through phases of criminalizing begging. Literally criminalizing begging, making it a criminal offense. And in the early 2010s, there was a big outcry around what is called IPNAS, so ultimately antisocial behavior, which included begging and loitering. So the ground was gray, and from what we understand, not that many people have been impugned with these IPNAS orders when it comes to them begging and sleeping outside, but there was legal grounds that people could have been. So we've historically gone through phases where both begging and shelter making were criminalized. What I'm seeing and what the kind of stories that I'm unearthing and I'm talking about in both my papers and in my books and the journalistic writing I do is that's very dangerous. The institutional setups are not sufficient. We don't have enough space simply for people to sleep inside. So the shelter making outside is a very important intermediate step for many of the people that I work with. We shouldn't criminalize that, right? There shouldn't be metal pieces put on the walls of a train station to prevent people from warming themselves up who are sleeping outside. Right. So again, on the flip side here, what could, and this is going one step further than what I usually do in my analysis, what could help here is we actually need to try and get people off the streets more quickly. And that is something that is quite well known, but also take care of them on the streets better. And obviously there is outreach teams who do that. And there's many drop-in services where people can come and spend time inside, even if it's just for warmth. And that takes me to the second point that I want to briefly focus on, safe injection facilities. So many of the people that I work with were not only sleeping outside and begging, they were also using drugs, mostly injecting drugs, mostly heroin, sometimes various different combinations of prescription pills that included opioids, as well as heroin and cocaine in its various different connotations and how it was sold on the different markets that I encountered. Many of them were migrants, many of them were quite young. Most of the people I worked with were men, which has to do with myself, but also with the fact that there's fortunately quite a bit proportion of support for women on the streets that makes it slightly easier for them to leave quickly. What wasn't the case when I did my work in Paris was that there was any kind of space for people who use drugs to do this safely. So the kind of station setup that you imagine, be it in London or be it in Paris or be it elsewhere, was where the drug trading happened, was where the drug taking happened, and was where the aftermath of the drug taking happened. Lots of neighbors complained about this to police in various different connotations. And it was that the time I was there, I was also during the two terror attacks. So there was massive amounts of police on the streets. We're clamping down drastically on the people who were just trying to go about their day. Drug addiction at this point in time for somebody who's been injecting for years is not about having pleasure. It's about preventing harm. It's about preventing pain from occurring. Addiction is a serious condition that you can't just stop ultimately. So the idea that pushing these people out and away from the street, out and away from the train station, without providing them any kind of space where they could be, is reasonably absurd. Fortunately, the Paris setup shifted just after I left the city, and they did open the first safe injection facility in 2017, which has since doubled in capacity and found two imitators in Marseille and another French city. So we've actually seen now that there was a massive campaign over years that led to the opening of the safe injection facility and people being allowed the long-term process of using more safely, which is what a safe injection facility does. They provide you with safe materials, syringes and needles, but also in a safe space without you having to struggle quickly to put the needle in, not hitting your vein, possibly hurting yourself, much more likely hurting yourself. And beyond that, leaving materials lying around, which then are suddenly dangerous sites for the neighbors or even just people passing through these non-spaces to be. And what has since happened?
Sorry, Johannes, yeah. We should, on that kind of more positive note, we should pass over to Simon soon, but do finish your train of thought.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what has since happened is that we've actually seen a lot of success with these particular sites that have been rolled out. And again, I think the Andrew vision that we can bring to this type of observation is that the stories matter more than the data. Talking to people about this and using these stories in a situation like a campaign, which is nothing that I was involved with in Paris, but was inspired to do now in Cambridge, is a very powerful application of what we see and what we observe and what we do. And I think also then have a responsibility to do.
Thank you. Thank you, Johannes, for that power of storytelling. Yeah. Simon, over to you. What's the relevance of all this work, Anthrovision?
Thank you, Alpa. So we all recognize the importance of social relations, to put it quite simply. This is something, for example, that Mayanka rightly emphasized, and also something that we all wish that the landlords in her case study, like Clarion, also recognized. So my recommendations and my sort of analysis of the relevance of my ethnography is also going to be pitched at quite a micro level, at the level of social relations on the front line. And they're really for organizations in an ideal world to take and implement at their own will. And really, they're informed by the wisdom and perspective of my former colleagues like Sarah. And the one thing that I want to focus on is the reformation of the organizational cultures in the UK homeless sector, partly because many of my former colleagues in Castlebury observed how hierarchical their workplaces are. So a very blue sky kind of suggestion would be to suggest that these organizations could consider a more egalitarian workplace ethos. In this vein, also the conditionality and enforced interventions that Johannes spoke about, where these are perhaps not clearly consented to, these need to be challenged, and we need to give the ability, the reflective space for people on the front line to challenge these issues as well. And I'll explain a little bit shortly about how. In particular, I was reminded by Sarah of the need for a wider awareness about the politics of providing these services. And I don't just mean this in the sense of left and right or electoral politics, but rather just the kind of power dynamics and the historical evolution of these relationships. And Sarah told me that there are a set of key questions that she wishes that more of her colleagues, and indeed more of her managers, actually ask themselves. And they are as follows. Who is this intervention for? Has the subject of this intervention requested this? Is it my managers or is it the organization's funders? How would the person at the heart of these actions want me to be involved? Really what Sarah is alluding to is a practice that's starting to grow in the homelessness sector that I worked in, which is known as reflective practice. And I view these quite favorably, of course. These are sessions where workers challenge themselves and each other and reflect on fraught issues through a kind of peer-led dialogue. To that, I would insert as another blue sky suggestion, what if we considered including the beneficiaries of these charities into such sessions as well? It's obviously a bit of a provocation. In fact, all of these things I'm mentioning so far are somewhat provocative. But in any case, I believe that this would duly recognize the reality, which is the inevitability of social relations in these institutions, in particular, how they do transcend the professional divide. Anyway, so I'll end by explaining a little bit about why these suggestions might be so provocative to some of my former colleagues, and as a result, also quite difficult to adopt. To put it briefly, these are about how these services are funded and commissioned. And the first difficulty with implementing these kind of blue sky ideas is the concept of homeless pathways. What a pathway is a prescription of the route that it takes for an aid seeker to go from service to service in a chain of reform. These are typically likened to as a staircase from the streets to a shelter, to a kind of dormitory style accommodation, and then to a flat share, and possibly to a self-contained property. But the final step is perhaps the most impossible step, partly because of the shortage of social housing, if not entirely because of that, in fact. Anyway, these pathways are formulated on a local governmental level, and they don't necessarily align with someone's own aspirations or their own life projects. So requesting compliance with this trajectory reinscribes the professional divide between worker and client. And indeed, clients who challenge this pathway are often considered non-engagers, or otherwise just a bit annoying or frustrating. And finally, the second reason why it's a bit hard to imagine the reformation of these organizational cultures in the UK is because of the fleeting nature of these charities and the fleeting nature of worker longevity. Since I came back from my field research in Castlebury, two of my former workplaces are now defunct. The staff turnover and the working conditions in the UK homelessness sector mirrors the social care sector more widely. A lot of this is down to the unpredictable nature of state funding, which these organizations centrally rely on. And also a lot of it is just to do with the difficult nature of confronting the contradictions and paradoxes of their everyday work. So in this context, to end on a slightly somber note, it is often quite difficult to recognize, well, it's often quite difficult to imagine that these relations I've spoken about of care and trust will be properly recognized by these institutions. But it is something that I do hope, and I hope we can also approach a better understanding of the obstacles to this more widely. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon, for that very sobering reflections. We talk more in the discussion, but let me hand over to Mayanka now before we open up the floor.
Thank you, Alpa. Like Johannes and Simon have said, it's hard to kind of think in very direct ways. So I've kind of thought more in how Simon says, you know, these kind of provocations and ways of shaking up some underlying basis of policy making, which is where I think anthropology and the anthro lens and the anthro vision can play a key role in, you know, kind of disputing certain singular understandings of what people want. There are kind of a few broad policy provocations that I think emerge from my work. The first one is that my research reveals, like I mentioned, the significance of land in the ways in which people carve out belonging in kind of central London. And, you know, this can be seen through the planting of trees or the visiting of graves or family trees that were drawn across my two sites to kind of demonstrate this long-term relationship between the people and Chelsea as a borough and, you know, what Chelsea's history meant. These land-based relationships, I say, need to be studied side by side alongside studying kind of financialization of housing and modern forms of capitalism and, you know, this investment-based model of housing, turning houses into financial assets, abstracting them. But I think that study needs to be kept side by side with the study of these very concrete attachments and concrete relationships to land and the question of land. So the crisis of housing needs to be studied alongside the unequal distribution of land, especially in a city like London, where very few families directly own land, you know, with the whole kind of leasehold and freehold division, where Cadogan family is the freehold and, you know, owns kind of 93 acres of land, in these kind of very high value real estate areas. The second one is that paying attention to care practices, which is something I think all three of our work does, this kind of paying attention to care practices helps break out of a certain simplistic binary drawn between care and emptiness, you know, as these kind of opposites. So yes, in a place like Sutton Estate, care practices did emerge against the form of decanting or emptying that was going on. But in Cadogan Square, for example, my second field site, care went hand in hand with emptiness. A lot of conservation practices that I spoke about that were kind of practices of formalized care turned houses in Cadogan Square into museological objects that needed to be cared for. And this care for this kind of heritage home was prioritized over the livability of homes. So for example, there was a couple who spoke about this one architectural feature that actually created a lot of chaos and noise in their house, you know, which is the light wells, which were, you know, of course, made before commercial flight paths were above Chelsea. And now these light wells, instead of capturing light, they capture this reverberating echo of the plains. But of course, this is a very significant historical aspect of this particular architecture. So just this whole idea of kind of care, architecture, heritage, emptiness, and how they relate to each other. The third one is that I show the importance of ethnographically studying what belonging means, and how people in London create this sense of belonging when they fear displacement or they fear the loss of their homes, such as in Sutton Estate, but also how people grapple with the idea of belonging to a place when they live away from their home and own these rich homes and they live in Australia and America, which were kind of the two places where I focused a lot of my acceptable empty homeowners category from, and how they create and forge this sense of attachment from afar, as I call it. And this can be a useful starting point to understand housing and housing crisis in contemporary London, by understanding how people live with empty homes as everyday realities, not as moments of crises. The fourth one is through focusing on gardening and grieving as my two kind of land-based practices in Sutton Estate, I demonstrate a very tactile relationship between people and land, like I said. The question of land needs to be at the heart of discussing housing crisis to bring attention to the people who actually draw profits from emptiness, be it social landlords like Clarion Housing, who decant social council estates to, you know, push for mixed rent housing, which maximizes their revenues, or be it the Cadogan family that owns 93 acres of land in central London. And, you know, Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea reported 74 empty commercial sites owned by the Cadogan estate, according to one of the Freedom of Information reports I looked at. And stepping away from some of the xenophobic narratives around empty homes that place all the blame on this racialized imagination of a foreign owner, it is important to look at land ownership of aristocratic estates in London, and to see how, while there is this kind of facade of community building and community custodianship, there is still this drawing of profit of empty home ownership. And this is something that can only be achieved by stepping away from a sensationalized view of empty homes that poses it as new, and instead taking up an anthropological and a historical approach to see all the forms of emptiness that exist in the city. The fifth one is that in a lot of housing policy directed meetings that I attended, there was often a sentimental binary drawn between house and home. And we often say this commonsensically as well, where, you know, there's a common argument that if only houses were, you know, not thought of as these abstract financial assets, but as homes, you know, that are cozy and warm and loved and lived in, then the crisis of empty houses could be averted. This results in several funds being directed towards community initiatives, especially in local councils, with the aspiration that it will create a greater sense of belonging. However, my research shows that people could very much love and feel belonging to their homes and still leave them empty for large parts of the year. And I interviewed, you know, several cleaners, for example, who were paid by direct debits by owners they never met, and they took care of these homes. There was a caretaker appointed in every, you know, building by the Cadogan family to ensure the upkeep of common areas, and to ensure that this whole house in totality stays maintained, even if some of the owners, you know, are not residential and kind of keep their houses empty. The emptiness of the flat enabled and facilitated certain forms of conservation and repair, like I mentioned in the first part of my presentation. And this is all to say that emptiness is very well ingrained within the workings of these luxury homes. So the trope of the community needs to be questioned and not uncritically accepted as always a positive thing, which is again something that anthropology as a lens can kind of reveal, these very kind of, you know, these very thorny bits about what a community means and what this facade of a community can mean. For instance, upon asking some of the residents of the square about which kind of emptiness they felt most uneasy about, they said it was the empty homes that didn't have Christmas lighting in December, which again shows that, you know, emptiness is not so much about presence or absence, but about the correct ways of demonstrating what it means to belong to London. Kind of finally, it's important, you know, this is what ethnography can reveal, that emptiness is not one thing, right? It's a process that unfolds very unevenly over time. It's a living process. And, you know, kind of emptying has been kind of ongoing, for example, in Sutton Estate, and, you know, it can still have life and sociality, and, you know, all of these things can still constitute emptiness. So in that sense, one has to step outside of this empty, full as binary categories when, you know, developing policy to deal with empty homes. So in sum, the anthropological lens reveals that empty homes is not a straightforward problem that can just be solved. Even as it might appear to be a viscerally unfair symbol of inequality in a city grappling with homelessness. By focusing on specific care practices that residents engage in to battle, conceal, or normalize emptiness across my two sites, my research extends beyond this policy approach of just solving emptiness and instead situates emptiness within everyday modes of living in London. To understand the crisis of empty homes, I argue, they cannot be separated from these everyday modalities of care and belonging that are unfolding right now at the heart of the city. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mayanka. Thank you, Simon and Johannes, for, it's just such rich and illuminating discussions and sharing your work with us and thinking through its relevance. I will open to our seminar, to our group for questions. You can raise your hand using the raise hand function, and I will take questions, or you can pose them in chat if you would really like, if you don't feel comfortable speaking. Let's see, I don't have anything in chat right now. But please, yeah, please gather your questions. And while you're gathering, Leanne, I see you've got a question. I'll give the floor to you, Leanne Freeman, and then maybe ask a couple of questions myself. Leanne.
Cool. Thanks, Alba, and thanks to all of the speakers for your sort of excellent presentations. Just to introduce myself as requested. My name's Leanne. I'm studying for my master's in social anthropology here at the LSE. But prior to resuming my studies, I was working in research consultancy in the charity sector, including for several charities that worked on homelessness. So my question is sort of best suited to Simon, but if either of the other speakers have any thoughts, I'd obviously be very glad to hear them. But sort of thinking about the role of anthropology in this space, just as I was leaving the sector, there was sort of a new enthusiasm for capturing the lived experiences of service unit users, particularly in sort of service design and evaluation. So I'm wondering if you were aware of this current, if it came up in your research, how you think it is perhaps currently carried out and where that limitation may be, and what you think anthropology, like particularly methods of ethnography, can contribute to this sort of move. Thank you.
Simon.
Leanne, thank you so much for this question. Also, this is a phenomenon that indeed did spring up right at the end of my fieldwork, really just after my fieldwork, but which a lot of my friends in the fields were quite impressed about, not necessarily positively impressed, I might say, largely because I know of at least two of my former interlocutors who are in fact anthropology graduates. So they have a very clear idea of what ethnography is, at least in the sense of the kind of Malinowskian, you know, deep immersive participant observation approach. Anyway, so this charity of where I worked, which my friends are still in, they described how they were being introduced to ethnographers who are going to study their organization. And the most amusing thing about all of this is they didn't make the connection between me as an ethnographer and them as an ethnographer. For some reason, I was a completely different species of ethnography altogether. And it was only with the introduction of this consultancy that they started to know what ethnography is. Anyway, to put it quite bluntly, they were very critical, they being my friends, of the ethnographic merits of these consultants. Partly because, to put it quite bluntly, it wasn't ethnography. This is and I hope I'll be forgiven for making that kind of discount. And the reason why is because I believe they only visited the organization twice, only to interview a specific set of people. And there were very preset interview questions that were defined. And the whole purpose of this consultancy's relationship with my former charity was because their funders, the council, had basically requested it because they were formulating a new policy. This basically opens up questions that are well known to anthropologists about to what extent can you do a good applied anthropology. But certainly based on the anecdotes that I hear from my very intelligent and very anthropologically attuned colleagues, that's not necessarily the way that we could be applying our anthro vision. We should allow more unfettered access to people in these organizations, and we should be prioritizing deep immersion. But this is obviously quite difficult anyway. But anyway, what a great question. Thank you.
Thank you. It reminds me a lot about, you know, the similar issues in international development, where you get these like kind of quick fix, you know, you speak to somebody, you call it ethnography, right? Age-old problems of how anthropology gets then used, ethnography especially gets used. Okay, we have Emily from the PhD who's doing a PhD administrator in the Department of Government. Emily, would you like to unmute yourself and ask your question?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I'm coming from outside of anthropology. I'm not an anthropologist, but have an interest in this topic. So I have a background in town planning, and so this element of displacement, especially from London, is quite a big deal, and obviously is reflected in quite a bit of your research. And my question is basically, compared to mainland Western Europe, which I suppose is our nearest sort of countries, and as I think it was Johannes did some research in Paris as well, so you can maybe speak to this. But basically, I suppose my point is, because in the UK, lots of our economy is centralised in London, does that create a particular unique problem with homelessness, displacement, and our housing crisis? And would levelling up, as the government keeps saying, potentially help some of the issues that have been uncovered here today? So it's a bit of a confusing question, but maybe you can speak to it.
Thank you, Emily. Great question. Maybe Johannes and Simon could have a go at that.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about the first bit. The short answer is the service provision system, as well as the reason for people to be on the street and in situations of homelessness, as well as what happens on the street. So the focus that I mostly cared about are very comparable. So I've seen three different setups, quasi-rural or small town, small city, Cambridge, massively metropolitan London, and for European cities, very metropolitan Paris, as well as spent some time in Berlin looking at this. And in a sense, the ecosystems, for lack of a better word, are very, very comparable. What happens in a place like London, and what happened when I was there, and I think continues to happen, is that people are treated slightly differently by certain institutional players. So what you're seeing, and this definitely has to do with what London is that people are pushed out explicitly of the city and into Tower Hamlets, where I was working on Shoreditch High Street at the time, which is literally where Tower Hamlets starts and where the city ends and where lots of the city workers now live and go out, so take their money. But the city police kind of particularly polices the boundaries of the particular borough, so to speak. And that is very, very different in Paris, where still the last time I was there and when I did my fieldwork there between 2014 and 16, you could, if you quote unquote behaved correctly, i.e. you were not too loud so that the neighbors didn't complain and you didn't leave rubbish around, camp almost on any pavement within boundaries. But that would not have been possible in London when I first started looking at this. There's a bit more leniency now, and I've been seeing this happen a little bit more, both in London and in Cambridge, but it was definitely not an option, and I think continues to not be an option in certain parts of the city, like this, certain parts of the city, London, like the city of London, so the financial district. But again, the kind of number of people who are experiencing homelessness, the distribution between who are the people on the streets, who are the people in shelters, who are the people in longer term housing, as well as the reasons and how you, Simon talked about this briefly, the pathway model, how you get out of homelessness are very, very similar across the European ecosystems, including the UK. I think once we talk about the US, we're really looking at a very different environment. Just to talk about the West, which is really what I know about.
Simon, my uncle, would you like to add anything to that?
I can go very, very briefly just to say that the idea of homelessness in the UK has got a very distinct cultural and historical genealogy, of course. This won't be surprising to you. But also the evolution of the responses to homelessness have a very specific and distinct historical genealogy in the UK. And the reason why I bring the two up is because I think we should see the two as conjoined, the evolution of the charities and our ideas of homelessness. To put it a little bit briefly, I think one of the biggest factors that has influenced the way that we think and respond to homelessness in the UK is the welfare state, of course, in particular the post-war welfare settlement. And I say that again as a in a positive sense and in a negative sense, partly the positive sense because thank heavens we have welfare benefits, but also in the negative sense because the 1945 settlement never actually intended to solve homelessness in the sense that we would now regard it. And in fact, the kind of previous poor law regime for responding to homelessness was only ever properly abolished in the 1960s or even in the 1970s, right? And this obviously blows our minds a lot of the time when we're at the LSE and we talk about Beveridge, because in a sense, Beveridge's legacy is actually quite partial. So that's a kind of, that's kind of to say that there's a very distinct UK, you know, taste that we add to the word as well, and very distinct histories. Thank you for the question.
Thanks. Mayanka, you were going to make a point about Sophie Chevalier's work, but maybe you can elaborate
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say that that's a very interesting question, because I think, of course, you know, within Europe as a category, there's such different treatments around these issues, and some things ways of comparing could be quite productive. So I think one thing that, of course, comes to mind with my work and in relationship to homelessness is the idea of squatting. And I think that's an interesting way of comparing between kind of continental Europe and Britain. And of course, you know, with especially with David Cameron's, you know, kind of very strong criminalization of squatting in comparison to kind of France and Germany, where the rules are quite different. It affects, you know, like the precise moment at which it becomes seen as illegal. And I think those kind of moments of when it slips into illegality and criminality is an interesting way of comparing. The other one that comes to mind is, of course, the imagination or aspiration of home ownership, which is, again, quite specific in the UK context in comparison to other ones. You know, a lot of the policy, even kind of very progressive policy, still goes with the assumption that people want to own homes, and home ownership is quite central to the sense of self, which again can be kind of seen as a basis of comparison. And the reference I mentioned was Sophie Chevalier, who has the paper that comes to mind is, I think, in Daniel Miller's book called Homes and Gardens. But in that, she kind of compares France and England in terms of forms of access to land ownership. And she says, because in France, more people have a conception of an ancestral home, versus in England, idea of a home very much kind of dies out with your lifespan. So it doesn't kind of continue in that sense. And how those kind of different temporalities of owning land versus owning a home affects the ways in which people relate to place and, you know, kind of sense of self and place. So yeah, that's kind of things that come to mind with what you've created as, I think, a very productive kind of form of comparison. Thank you.
Thanks. Can I ask a question about comparison as well, in the same, just a same, the same direction, but going somewhere else with Mayanka? I mean, it's something that I was trying to understand better when you presented at the Friday seminar. I appreciate, you know, that we need to unpack, you know, what is this emptiness and how it emerges differently, how Anthrovision makes us challenge it, you know, through looking at these practices of care and belonging. But I think I'd like to understand better, what are the differences between these two communities that you studied? Yeah, like you've studied like two very contrasting situations, like, you know, people on a council estate and people who own these like multi-million pound flats, right? And I can, you know, totally imagine a situation where those empty, so-called empty flats are, of course, being really cared for. I mean, that is part of why they are this kind of long financial asset. It's not just about the belonging, but it's also, you know, that is what creates, you know, value in all kinds of ways, right? But I'd like to understand, I guess, better the differences, like what are the differences that you, the analytical differences that are useful to think about the differences between these communities? Or is the point that we should have anthropological concepts which are about which traverse communities, you know? So are we thinking here about concepts which go, you know, doesn't matter, you can apply them in any context, or what are the salient differences that are emerging, or is, you know, so I'm trying, I want to understand better what your Anthrovision reveals about things like class difference, which are obviously mark the two communities that you study.
Thank you, Alpa. I mean, it's a question kind of also more broadly around what, you know, how useful is comparison as a device? And, you know, because of course there's a certain element where is it kind of just arbitrary kind of pitching these two things that visibly are very different groups of people. But of course there's some sense where, you know, they're geographically very close, and in a sense, often too close, you know, in the sense that there are more, the closeness can create forms of friction. There was one pub where I went where I met interlocutors from both of my field sites. And, you know, kind of it was interesting to, again, think about this idea of certain shared spaces within this borough, which were common across the sites. But since your question is more focused on the differences rather than kind of the shared overlaps between the sites, I do think, you know, to your kind of second question, I do think it's important to think about these differences. I don't think that my project, through my project, I was trying to say that the experiences of emptiness or a certain form of, you know, care or alienation is totally shared across the sites. But I think my idea was to kind of A, challenge the notion of what we imagine when we imagine empty houses, and B, kind of also challenge the imagination of Chelsea. Because of course, when you think of Chelsea, you think of a certain kind of posh borough, and you know, it is kind of a very wealthy borough, but then it's also marked by these A, steeped in class inequalities, but also when I speak to a lot of people from Sutton Estate, they think of Chelsea very much as not this kind of posh borough, but it's history of kind of, you know, a certain form of like artistic history, a certain form of, you know, people living there and partying there. So there's a very different history that is evoked of Chelsea. So I think it's also about certain identities that places in London develop. And for me, this kind of comparison kind of prevented me from going into a singular imagination of the past, which is why when I was thinking of belonging, people across my sites evoked a certain imagination of what Chelsea is or what Chelsea was and how they fit into it, which I thought was a kind of a productive way of comparing the two things, because they were, you know, both the sites were talking about kind of taking up place or setting up roots within this area of Chelsea. The thing where the comparison became quite stark was in terms of the idea of community, which is something I kind of talk about quite a bit in my thesis as well, where the community in that sense felt much more physical in the council estate, also because it was a space where the garden became a very explicit site of showing, outperforming this community. And, you know, there was also a certain, there was a certain kind of lurking threat of displacement, which brought people together through the political campaigns, through gardening. So I think there was a much more physically observable community when I was, you know, working in Sutton Estate, in opposition to the community which seemed much more imagined when I was working in Cadogan Square. And I think that was quite interesting. So, for example, we once went for this one incident that everybody talked, you know, everybody I was talking to mentioned, was that there was carol singing that happened in one, you know, around Christmas. Christmas was a very big theme, but there was this carol singing that happened. And, you know, the group that went from Holy Trinity Church with the rector, they went around and there was no applause. You know, only one or two people popped their heads out of their windows. And this was seen as a very kind of this moment of crisis for the neighbors who went, because they were like, oh, suddenly it's hit us that actually we had this very ghostly, eerie emptiness. So I think in that sense, interesting, but they still kept speaking about the idea of a community, you know, and I think, you know, I spoke a lot to the rector, Father Nicholas, who kind of spoke about how he really misses this idea of a rich, you know, church community and things like that. So I think in that sense, interesting about how immaterial the community or the ideas of community felt in Cadogan Square, especially with Cadogan family talking about, you know, how they really want to build a community, even though they were actually deriving so many profits of these empty houses. And the, you know, the rector of the church himself said that he's under a lot of conflict because he's appointed by the Cadogan, the Earl Cadogan is who appoints the rector. But then he also wants to be honest about what, you know, what families like this do to an area. So I think in that sense, it's interesting to think about this very material physical community in one sense, and then this kind of very abstract, imagined immaterial community that was being evoked as a way of saying, you know, character of Chelsea and things like that. So yeah, just kind of those, for me, became productive ways of comparing the two sides.
Wonderful, thanks. Yeah, and I'm really aware also that you've been working with storytelling too, right? In your work, and there's probably insights that you can share that really would be great to hear how you've been using, you know, telling of stories in relation to, you know, what Johannes has suggested to us earlier, and whether, you know, Simon sees space for storytelling as alternative forms of, you know, engaging anthropology in a deeper way than the kind of involvement that Leanne was suggesting. But I leave that to you to answer, maybe in a rounding up of comments at the end. But let me hand over to Faraz, maybe for the last question, or if anybody else has any other questions, please do raise your hands now and I will call you. But Faraz, over to you, and then maybe some last thoughts from our speakers.
Thanks, Alpa, and thanks to all the presenters for a really interesting session. I'm trying to pull in a lot of threads here, so apologies if my question sounds a bit confused. But I was really thinking along the lines of something you said, Johannes, and my uncle, you mentioned as well, about the increasing, at times, carceralization of the state's approach to homelessness, right? And we see that in, like, hostile architecture, you know, that's hostile to people experiencing homelessness, that, you know, puts up these like, you know, spikes and metal guards, but also that we're looking at, you know, in the UK, the really strict criminalization of squatting, and quite recent as well, right? Like we're now only like commercial buildings can even be squatted. And if you go into a residential building, like it's just off and it's just straight away criminalized. There's no even initial period. What my thinking is does this sort of like lead to a feedback loop where the homeless community or people experiencing homelessness come to see the state and its attempts to care for them, and like those align with the state, right? Which is like the NGOs and charities working in the homelessness sector that, you know, ultimately draw a lot of their funding from the state. Does that lead to a hostility perhaps? Is that something that you've come across in your fieldwork, in your interlocutors, that, you know, that breeds some sort of hostility and distrust towards the state and sort of leads to this like vicious cycle in which, you know, the state in turn like increases, like further criminalizes or further scapegoats the homeless community for all sorts of social ills, and you know it just keeps on getting worse. And I'm just wondering like how since Simon, you've mentioned like, you know, there is this change that you've seen and like it has become more lenient, what do you think has been behind this change, right? Like aside from the campaign and like what the most effective tools for those campaigns were. And on a slightly related note, like, you know, and this might be a bit unfair to ask you, but I'm thinking of context in the Global South, right? Where I'm looking to do my PhD fieldwork, and with a lot of my interlocutors who will be potentially experiencing homelessness at different points. I'm just wondering, in a context where this carceral arm or carceral face of the state is a lot more present, right? And there is much less in terms of like, you know, state welfare provision or even like, you know, thought of pathways out of homelessness. Like the entire like idea is just to drive these people out of the city or just, you know, push them underground. What you think, you know, could sort of break that cycle? But yeah, would love to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Maybe Simon, you first, and maybe we can take this as a kind of final round of any comments if you want to address each other's presentations as well. Just final round of thoughts.
Thank Simon, you, Alpha. First. Thank you.
Then Manka, then Johannes. Yeah.
Thank you, Faris, for the question. I'll try to keep it very, very brief because I quite like your insights, to be honest. To keep it brief, I'd say that yes, what you've done is to highlight the extent to which homelessness is deeply political. Yes, certainly. In terms of the relationship that this kind of cultivates between the state and the NGOs that are funded by the state, and also, you know, this whole kind of matrix and this whole kind of landscape of organizations, I'd say it's a lot more ambivalent than a feedback loop, although there are aspects of that kind of looping as well. But it's very hard to give a sort of big kind of characterization, because these organizations, and indeed the state itself, as we know as anthropologists, is deeply fragmented, and the landscape is deeply, deeply fragmented. So I'd characterize it more as ambivalence than anything else. A bit like with the rector in the church that my uncle was talking about there, it sounds like a real ambivalence, right? Like, what do you do when someone's funding you, but at the same time you don't like what they do? You know, it's that kind of thing. And in terms of how do these ideas apply in the Global South, the first thing to say would be that to some extent the ideas and responses to homelessness are going to be quite culturally specific. Like what I hope to have spoken about today is how actually I've been talking about English homelessness, and I don't really make any claims for the universality of these responses. Indeed, these are very specific situations I'm talking about. And I think it's for anthropologists to figure out in what ways actually homelessness is quite culturally specific in a lot of ways, and indeed politically and historically specific. I hope that's some kind of useful response. Thank you again for your question.
Thank you, Simon. Mayanka, some last thoughts and before I hand over to Johannes.
I think Simon wrapped that up quite nicely around what I suppose for us put as this kind of endless loop of this presence of the state. I think what's also important to remember is when it comes to housing in London, there's so many forms of institutional and formal power beyond the state that are also involved. And I think this is part of the reason why, for me, it was interesting to look at Cadogan family or, you know, Duke of Westminster, was the Grosvenor estate, and look at this, you know, kind of very strange and very bizarre model of capital ownership in the city and their relation to local councillors, for example, because, you know, there were times when, like some of the residents told me how Earl Cadogan held this very big, like a party in the Natural History Museum, and how he spoke about how when he was young, you know, he would have the key to this museum, and at night he would go running around. I mean, it's just bizarre when you think of these kind of lives of the, you know, super wealthy in London, where Earl Cadogan's family is married to Hans Sloane, who's the Sloane Street owner. So when you just think about all of these families who literally own London, and how in their family trees you can literally trace the geography of London, central London, I think it also tells you that there are many kind of forms of power, some more obvious, some more democratically elected, like the state, than others, which are kind of based through these kind of family lineages. And I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it when we think of housing crisis and, you know, who to direct them to. And just as a wrap-up thought, I suppose Alpha mentioned this, and Johannes mentioned this idea of storytelling. And I think stories have always been very, very powerful. For me, you know, more than even a narrative device, they've been a very good way of getting access and building trust and, you know, doing something concrete with interlocutors. Because of course, when you're telling a story, you're sitting in this collective collaborative project of writing a story, especially because what I do is kind of ethnofiction. So it's something where we're actually making up something. It's also a product of co-imagination, which I think is a very big part of doing ethnography. But at the same time, I think to keep a criticality, I think it is important to ask, where are these stories being used? And are they simply being used to supplement? I mean, one of the things is with the Ministry of Housing or whatever, Leveling Up Housing Ministry, sometimes I kind of, you know, I got an email from somebody who works there to say, do you want to come and share some of your stories? And for me, it's something which is very important to bring stories to important decision-making places, but it's also very important to critically think about, what are these stories doing? You know, are they simply something which is, you know, creating a momentary window of empathy for them to not affect structural decisions at all? And are we actually reinforcing this binary between, you know, the quantitative decision-making world of the powerful versus these kind of, you know, small interventions of stories which are not really, you know, doing this? And can we actually think of stories in a more radical way, of, you know, as theorizing devices, as ways of like actually shaping policy, not simply kind of, you know, being those little asterisks at the end, like an end note. So yeah, I think in that sense, of course, stories are important, but we really have to think about the full power of stories rather than kind of using them as additional device. I think that's when the true radical potential of ethnography, I suppose, can emerge.
I guess, you know, that's what journalists are doing right now with the Russian oligarchs, you know. I'm thinking of Oliver Bollo's brilliant storytelling powers of, you know, what it is that makes London and the role of Russian oligarchs and how we've enabled them, you know, to have all these assets. Yeah, right. So yeah, so maybe, you know, we're coming closer to that, and there we have to now then think about, you know, what is it that we as bringing as ethnographers specifically. But I just realized that I actually have an answer to my question to you, Mayanka, which is to move beyond the kind of challenging of emptiness. It would be really interesting to hear more from you about the different kinds of practices of care that you find like in the council estates versus these kind of old aristocratic families versus, say, you know, the kind of new capitalist, the Russian oligarchs, as different kind of capital, right? And the kinds of practices of care and imagination and belonging probably quite different. And to draw all of these differences out would be, I think, fascinating, you know, or where they overlap, but where they're different. Anyway, Johannes, you have the last word. We're due to close to go to the party, some of you, but yeah, over to you.
Perhaps just a last point on not only collecting these stories and writing them up and publishing them in book form, which is still the medium that we use quite a bit, and then in academic articles that are behind paywalls, so quite shut away. I would want to encourage everyone, particularly the people who are not yet at this stage, that they have their PhDs and they have a book out, and that in theory and makes you qualified to go beyond that. But to start thinking about how you can use these stories beyond the academic context, I think in my education in particular, it was always about how to be a good academic. I think we are sometimes losing a little bit of touch with why I'm doing this work is not at all to have a conversation with anthropologists. It's to tell other people about this and ideally tell other people about this who can then change something about the situations I'm observing. So I'd encourage everyone to use the stories that we're collecting and publish them journalistically, practice that more, write as early as possible and as different a medium as you can, because in the end, it's just another genre that you can easily learn how to do. And we're actually quite well set up to do that as anthropologists. And then search out policymakers, search conversations, apply for tenders. Right, this is how I first got in touch with these direct interactions with policymakers. We are very well qualified to do that. And people actually now increasingly like listening to stories and take them seriously.
A wonderful note to end on, Johanna, says Sam and Mayanka will know that's exactly what we've, you know, been trying to shift in the department, you know, in the conversations we've been having around writing and why we write and the kinds of ethnographies we're producing. So thank you very much for leaving us on that. Thank you to Sam and thank you, Mayanka. It's been really great to have you all in conversation. Thank you to the III for hosting this event. There's the next events are up on the in the chat box. Do come along. And thank you to the BSL interpreters.